Have you ever found yourself watching a crime drama and wondering, how far is too far? You know, when the police are questioning someone, where exactly is that line between clever investigation and trampling on someone's rights? Today, we're diving headfirst into a fascinating legal thicket, courtesy of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court in the 1995 case Commonwealth v. Selby. This case grapples with precisely that question.
Exactly. This deep dive is going to dissect the legal boundaries that govern police interrogations, particularly when those interrogations involve some level of trickery or deception.
Right.
We'll be zeroing in on the Selby decision and what the court actually had to say about when a confession obtained through such tactics can still be used as evidence.
Mm.
Ultimately, it's about understanding what makes a statement truly voluntary in the eyes of the law.
And we've got a pretty solid foundation for our discussion today. We're working with the actual opinion from the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts in Commonwealth v. Selby, which gives us all the nitty-gritty details, the who, what, when, where, and, well, most importantly, the legal reasoning.
Yeah.
We also have a concise case brief that distills the core elements and a standard legal brief outlining the rule of law, the central issue, the facts of the case, the court's analysis, and the key takeaways. Our goal today is to synthesize all of this for you, giving you a clear and insightful understanding of why this case remains so relevant.
So let's jump right into the specifics then. What exactly unfolded in the Selby case that brought this critical issue of deceptive interrogation tactics before the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court?
Okay, let's unpack this. Corey Selby was convicted of first-degree murder, which included both the element of deliberate premeditation and the charge of felony murder. For those who might not be familiar, felony murder is a legal rule where someone can be held responsible for a death that occurs during the commission of a felony, even if they weren't, you know, the one who directly caused the death.
Right.
Selby's conviction stemmed from a home break-in where, tragically, someone was fatally shot. Now, during the police interrogation, investigators employed a specific tactic that's really central to our discussion. They directly told Selby that they had recovered his handprint from the crime scene, the catch. That wasn't true.
And it was after being presented with this supposed handprint evidence that Selby confessed, is that right?
Precisely. However, Selby later challenged the admissibility of this confession, arguing that it wasn't truly voluntary because it was induced by the police's deceptive claim about the handprint. He essentially argued his will was overborne by this lie.
And this is where the procedural history becomes important, yeah?
Yeah.
What was the initial ruling on Selby's attempt to have the confession excluded from evidence?
Well, the trial court, the Superior Court, didn't agree with Selby's argument. They denied his motion to suppress, meaning they ruled that the confession could be used at trial.
Oh.
Naturally, Selby appealed this decision, and it eventually landed before the highest court in Massachusetts, the Supreme Judicial Court. And that's where our primary source, the court's written opinion, comes from.
So at the heart of this appeal was a really fundamental legal question that I'm sure many of you listening have pondered. Does the use of deceptive tactics by the police during an interrogation automatically render any resulting confession involuntary and therefore inadmissible in court?
Mm.
Did this specific act of falsely claiming they had his handprint violate Selby's constitutional rights?
Exactly. The Supreme Judicial Court had to determine whether Selby's confession was truly a product of his own free will, considering all the circumstances surrounding the interrogation, what they refer to as the totality of circumstances.
Right, that phrase.
Yeah. And crucially, they had to decide if this particular instance of police deception crossed a legal line that would make the confession invalid.
And this concept of the totality of circumstances is like a cornerstone in many legal analyses, especially when we're talking about the voluntariness of confessions.
Yeah.
What specific factors did the court consider in Selby's case when applying this test?
Well, the court's approach is essentially a balancing act. You know, they don't just look at the one instance of deception in isolation.
Right.
Instead, they weigh a variety of factors to determine if Selby's decision to confess was a free and rational choice. In Selby's case, several key elements stood out. First, the court noted that Selby was given his Miranda warnings, you know, the warnings about the right to remain silent and the right to an attorney multiple times throughout the interrogation.
Multiple times.
And each time, Selby indicated that he understood these rights.
Right. Those Miranda warnings are absolutely fundamental. They are designed to protect an individual's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination during custodial interrogations. The fact that they were repeatedly administered and acknowledged is a significant point.
Absolutely. The court also considered the fact that Selby was described by the interrogating officers as being sober, alert, and lucid throughout the questioning.
Mm-hmm.
There was no indication that he was under the influence of drugs or alcohol or suffering from any mental impairment that might have affected his ability to understand the situation or make rational decisions.
Okay.
And importantly, the court found no evidence of any physical coercion whatsoever. There were no allegations of threats, violence, or any other overtly coercive tactics used by the police.
So you can begin to see the picture the court is painting.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just about the lie in isolation, mm-hmm. was it? They were looking at all these surrounding factors that suggested Selby understood his rights and wasn't physically or mentally compelled to speak against his will. What's so critical here for you to understand is that the court is trying to balance the need for law enforcement to solve crimes with the fundamental right against self-incrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Allowing some deception acknowledges the adversarial nature of investigations, but the line is drawn where that deception fundamentally undermines the suspect's ability to make a free and rational choice. For you, the listener, this multi-factor test is crucial because it acts as a safeguard, preventing a single act of deception from automatically invalidating a confession while still allowing courts to examine the entire context to ensure someone's will wasn't truly broken.
Okay, so the court looks at the big picture, but where exactly is that line between the kind of deception used in Selby's case, the false handprint, and the type of police conduct that would cross over into impermissible coercion?
That's the central question, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the court in Selby provided some important guidance. They made a key distinction. Deception, in and of itself, does not automatically equate to coercion.
Right.
They stated that for a deceptive tactic to render a confession involuntary, it must be so egregious that it overbears the suspect's will.
Yeah.
It has to be the kind of trickery that essentially breaks down a person's resistance to the point where their confession is no longer a product of their own free choice.
So not just any lie.
Not just any lie. Think of it like someone being under so much psychological pressure, like maybe being deprived of sleep and constantly interrogated for days, although that wasn't the case here, that they'll say anything just to make it stop. That's the kind of extreme situation the court is trying to avoid.
And the court even referred back to a prior Massachusetts case, Commonwealth v. Meehan, to help illustrate this distinction, didn't they?
Exactly. In Meehan, the court had upheld the admissibility of a confession, even though the police had used a form of trickery in that case, showing the suspect fake fingerprints.
Ah, similar tactic then.
It's very similar. The crucial principle that the Selby court reaffirmed from Meehan is that as long as the police respect a suspect's Miranda rights, some level of deception is considered permissible. The idea is that a suspect who is aware of their rights and capable of exercising them still has the ability to make a choice, even in the face of some misleading information.
This raises a really important point for you listening. What kinds of deceptive tactics do you think might cross that line from permissible trickery into coercive behavior? Where do you see that ethical and legal boundary? It's a question that legal scholars and practitioners grapple with constantly.
Now, there was another significant aspect of the Selby case that's worth exploring. Selby's response at the very end of the interrogation, when the police asked him if he had anything further to add to his statement, he simply replied, no.
Just no.
Just no. His defense argued that this no was an attempt to invoke his right to remain silent and that the interrogation should have ceased at that point. What was the court's interpretation of this?
Yeah, the court didn't agree with the defense's interpretation. They concluded that Selby's single word no wasn't a clear and unambiguous indication that he wanted to stop talking.
And the legal standard for invoking the right to silence is quite demanding, isn't it? The courts generally require a suspect to make their desire to remain silent unequivocally clear.
Precisely. The court in Selby emphasized that if a suspect wishes to end an interrogation by invoking their right to silence, they need to use clear and unambiguous language. Saying something like, I don't want to talk anymore, or I'm invoking my right to remain silent, leaves no room for misinterpretation.
Mm-hmm.
A simple no in response to a routine closing question, in the court's view, just didn't meet that threshold of clarity.
And this has very practical implications for anyone who might find themselves in a police interrogation, doesn't it? It underscores the importance of being precise and explicit if you want to assert your constitutional rights. Ambiguous statements can, well, they can be interpreted against you.
Definitely. So as we start to wrap up our deep dive into Commonwealth v. Selby, let's crystallize the key takeaways. What are the most important principles that someone studying the law should remember from this case?
Well, the first crucial point, I think, is that Selby reaffirms the principle that while police cannot employ overtly coercive tactics, they are afforded some latitude when it comes to using deception during interrogations.
Right.
However, the ultimate determination of whether a resulting confession is admissible hinges on the totality of the circumstances surrounding the interrogation. It's not just the lie itself.
And the repeated administration and acknowledgement of Miranda warnings remain absolutely critical. In the Selby case, this was a significant factor supporting the court's conclusion that the confession was voluntary, right?
Absolutely. And the suspect's mental and physical state during the interrogation is another key piece of the puzzle. Selby's sobriety and apparent lucidity were factors that weighed in favor of the court finding his confession voluntary.
And we must also remember the nature of the police conduct itself. The courts will always scrutinize the interrogation tactics employed to determine whether they were merely deceptive or if they crossed the line into coercive behavior that ultimately overbore the suspect's free will.
Exactly. For law students, Selby serves as a really important illustration that even in situations where police use deceptive tactics, a confession can still be deemed admissible in court. The central inquiry remains whether the suspect's free will was overcome and whether their fundamental rights, particularly their Miranda rights, were respected throughout the process. The totality of circumstances test is truly the lens through which all of these factors are examined and weighed.
So, as Commonwealth v. Selby so clearly demonstrates, the legal landscape surrounding police interrogations is complex and nuanced. While a lie by the police during questioning isn't automatically going to lead to a confession being thrown out, the courts are going to thoroughly examine all the surrounding circumstances to ensure that the confession was genuinely the product of the individual's free will.
And that leads us to a final thought for you to consider. Reflecting on the Selby ruling, what considerations do you believe law enforcement agencies should take into account when developing and implementing their interrogation strategies? And as our understanding of the human mind and decision-making processes evolves through psychology and other fields, how might that influence the legal interpretation of what constitutes overbearing a suspect's will in future cases? This landmark decision really highlights the ongoing and delicate balance between the critical need for effective law enforcement and, well, the fundamental protection of individual liberties within our legal system.